On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, it's been a week where aviation has been in the news, largely for, you might say, the wrong reasons. There's been the clash between Ryanair and the government, the ongoing void in policy, the traffic light system that we don't know whether it's going to kick in a couple of weeks or not, and more questions around the future of jobs in the industry. But here's the thing about the story of Irish commercial aviation. You'd probably be forgiven for thinking that aviation in Ireland began with Aer Lingus and Shamrock Livery and all the stuff that you associate with Aer Lingus. But instead, it all starts with a field of dreams in Finglas, which is the sort of sentence that only Donald Fallon could write in an intro. We'll come back to you on that one. A field of dreams in Finglas, where one Irish businessman and an automobile enthusiast dared to take to the skies long before Aer Lingus was ever in the skies. The name was big, Iona National Airways, but it wasn't quite a national airline so much as a sign of what was to come. And Donald Fallon is here to tell us.
He should have called it Aer Finglas.
Imagine if there had been confusion between Aer Fingus and Aer Lingus. Like you'd have had such a confusing time of it all. Aer Lingus is not our primary subject today, Donal, in this slot, and thank you for coming in as ever. But Aer Lingus itself, actually, before we get to Iona, Aer Lingus came from fairly humble beginnings too, didn't it?
It did. And, you know, in Irish commercial history, I think that the shamrock of Aer Lingus, it's perhaps only second to the toucan of John Gilroy, you know, as a symbol of Irish commercial success. Aer Lingus, born in 36, it is still one of the definitive symbols of Irish business. And of course, you know, it's no longer a national airline. It's a privately owned airline. It's pretty much a flag carrier,
rather than
a national airline. But, I mean, the story of Aer Lingus is beautiful in itself. I mean, it began with just £100,000 in capital from Baldonnell Airfield, which was a military airbase, you know, not exactly the normal launching pad for a commercial airline. One plane, a six-seater. A second plane with a capacity for 14 passengers was soon added. Now, you'd be lucky to get 14 passengers on a plane these days. But anyway,
these two
planes connected Dublin to London via Bristol and Liverpool. And I think it's important to understand, you know, the birth of Aer Lingus in the bigger context of what was happening in Ireland in the 1930s. You know, that Fianna Fáil government, Lammas, Dev, and the focus on creating Irish industry and commercial interest. Bord na Mona, the Irish Life Assurance Board, the Irish Tourist Board, and Aer Lingus, to me, they're all part of that one kind of Lamassian vision,
so
you might say.
You're kind of talking about the late 1930s, and you're still talking about economic war and the idea of trying to turn Ireland into an economic superpower, which was maybe a few decades short of its time. But anyway, before Aer Lingus in 1936, 5 years beforehand, it was the private sector, which we're talking about today, which produced the first Irish airline.
It's incredible. I mean, 5 years earlier, the first attempt at an Irish airline, and on the north side of Dublin, Hugh Cahill, businessman with a background in the automobile industry, he launches the brilliantly named Iona National Air. I love this idea.
It's like, very grand.
It's grand. Yeah. I think businessmen, you know, you need to think big. You don't think about what you have now, you think about what you will have down the road. So he calls it Iona National Airways. Yeah. And from really humble beginnings would come a flight school, air taxis, the first airport, first recognisable kind of non-military airport in Dublin. And I would argue, I think this guy, Hugh Cahill, kind of pushed the state, you know, the imperative for the state to do something and to establish its own airline.
Iona in itself is even a very grand name as well, because Iona is the island off Scotland that Colm Kyll went to. So it has this kind of image of the Irish going out beyond their island and striking and making new cultures elsewhere. This is the 1930s, and there's really then an obsession with the skies, because the skies and flying and aviation is all seen as so new.
It is. And flying is a luxury that we take it for granted now. I mean, just this morning I was trying to think, how many times was I on a plane last year? I was in the air 8 times last year, 4 trips, twice on journeys to the UK that cost about the same as a bus to Galway or Belfast.
It's
extraordinary how often we're in the sky now. And it's such a normal experience that I think it's lost its magic, basically, except for the very young. And you can always see when you're on a plane, you know, who's in the sky for the first time, to be conscious that they're in the sky. Mm. And they're obsessed with the kind of science of how a plane stays up there. But in the early 20th century, the world, everyone was obsessed with flying, and there was no low-budget airlines. You know, it was a distant dream for most of us. There was Alcock and Brown, who would fly a modified First World War plane from Newfoundland to Clifton, Connemara in 1919. Incredible. You know, the first transatlantic flight.
Yeah.
For many years, there was a monument of those two men at Heathrow Airport. Brilliantly, last year, they moved it to Clifton, which I thought was great.
That's lovely. But that's mad, actually. Sorry to interrupt you. It's mad that was 1919, because the Wright brothers only got their own heavier-than-air thing going in 1903.
Exactly.
And if you think about this, the scale at which went, and even if just park aviation for a minute, in 1903, humans flew.
Yeah.
Flew. In the 1950s, they were in space. In 1969, we're on the moon.
Yeah,
like the scale of endeavour of that is
in just what is the blink of an eye, you know, in the context of human history.
Yeah.
And there were local heroes, James Fitzmaurice, you know, from the North Circular Road. He was a member of the crew of the Bremen. That was the first successful transatlantic aeroplane flight the other way, east to west. And if anyone is ever in New York City on Broadway, his name is there, you know, one of the granite strips. It honours anyone who had a ticker tape parade through Manhattan. They did that in 1928. So, you know, a young lad from the North Secular Road had flown across the world. Everyone was kind of obsessed with the skies. And I think everyone felt on some level that they one day may be lucky enough to be up there.
You know, you've just broken my heart there because you just said, oh, his name is in a plaque on Broadway. And I said, I must go and look at that the next time I'm in New York. And then I go, when is the next time any of us
in 2026.
Yeah, it's going to be a while before we're ever going back there recreation again, unfortunately. Talk to me then about the founder of Iona, Hugh Cahill. He made his money, as you said, in cars, and he found his inspiration very locally.
Yeah, background in automobiles. And he's among the people who catches the bug, so to speak, the obsession with the sky. And his car garage was located across Guns Bridge, Phibsborough. That's now the location of the Bernard Shaw pub, you know, which has flown itself across the River Liffey from the south side to the north side. So, you know, the next time you're at the Bernard Shaw, you're standing in the birthplace of Irish aviation, which is kind of weird.
Wow.
But if listeners know the geography of Phibsborough at all, the street names around there, you have Iona Road, Iona Park, Iona Crescent, they're all named in honour of St. Columba, as you touched on earlier on. Mm. So he takes the name from this, you know, for his automobile company from the local area, and now he adopts it for the skies. And at nearby Finglas, a field becomes the Kildonan Aerodrome. And to be honest, the government of the day, I think they regarded Cahill as a bit mad. They didn't take too much interest in what he was doing.
Mm.
But that government was capable of doing amazing things. You know, Ardna Crusher proved that. But I think aviation was just kind of little explored or prioritised. That will come later on. And he was a brilliant promoter of the idea, Cahill. I mean, he brought it to everyone's mind. A few small mock planes, the aeroplanes of the day, training. So he offers, you know, to train others to take off to the sky. And I think what's really interesting in the newspaper reports, young women seem to have been particularly interested in learning how to fly from the very beginning.
How was flying perceived? Obviously, it was a bit of a novelty and everyone was still, you know, very enthused about it because it was so new in the 1930s. But was it seen as being a very mainstream thing, or was it still seen as a little bit cutthroat or daredevil?
A bit daredevil, yeah. And I mean, some of the trainee pilots of the Iona school get themselves in trouble for various things like hedge hopping, which is bringing the plane down as low as you can over field. And hopping up and down. You know, there is a real maverick daredevil kind of character who wants to get into a plane in the early 20th century. But I think Cahill really put his faith in the air taxi idea. He thought you could revolutionise how we get around the island of Ireland, which is very, very small. But the problem was, there's no national infrastructure. So you might have your little airport in Finglas, but how are you going to land people in Galway, in Waterford, in Cork? You know, where are you going to land them? So you get these great press reports of the early days when he's trying to land planes. There's a lovely report from the Mead Chronicle when a small moth plane, the property of Iona National Airways, alighted at the Cattlefield Trim on Wednesday. Large crowds gathered to the spot and curiously examined the machine. It's like the future landed in this field, you know, in rural Ireland. And people went out to have a look at it. But he tried some great kind of stunts to promote flying. And the one I love is that they flew low over a football match and dropped the ball into play from the sky.
That is the sort of thing that would definitely get you noticed, because instead of it being like the Archbishop of Cashel and Emly who's throwing in the ball at the start of an All-Ireland final,
it's Iona from the sky.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Amazing. And then today, the aviation industry has always been, you know, synonymous with advertising. It's very cutthroat now. You have the humour of Ryanair, the iconography of Aer Lingus. But here was Iona, you know, dropping footballs from the sky.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Shout out to the Meath Chronicle as well. A fine institution, if I do say so myself. After Hugh Cahill, then, the aerodrome gets taken over by someone who was very, very well known, arguably the most famous woman in the world.
It was a great idea, and like a lot of great ideas in Irish history. James Joyce opened the first ever cinema, and that didn't work. You know, it was a great idea, but it was a great idea too early in Cahill's case. And after 2 years, he kind of gave up on the Finglas Airport idea. But it was sold to Lady Heath, who was perhaps the most famous woman in the world in her day, from Limerick, but very Anglo-Irish in how she carried herself. You know, she was the first woman to hold the commercial flying licence in Britain, the first woman to parachute from an aeroplane in England. Brilliantly, she landed in the middle of a football match.
did she bring the ball down to kick off?
You couldn't make this stuff up. And Charles Lindbergh, you know, in America, was the icon of generations of American kids.
Yeah.
By comparison, Lady Heath was known as Britain's Lady Lindy. I mean, she was a massive, massive name. Now, by the time she arrives and takes over this kind of decaying airport in Finglas, the best days are behind her. One of the trainee pilots had a great line about her. Catherine Butler said, by the time she took over Kildonan, she was in pretty bad shape, partly due to the result of an accident which left her with steel plates in her skull.
So, many. When he said she was in bad shape, I wasn't sure whether you meant the lady or Kildonald. Oh. Okay, so we're talking about Lady Heath herself here.
Many
still
and varied
her skull.
Many and varied were the stories with which she regaled us, beginning with her romances. And in this area, she was an expert, having been married 3 times. So there was something surreal about this kind of living legend of the skies, you know, whose life had come a little bit unhinged, running a flying school in Dublin. And again, young women overwhelmingly seemed to be drawn towards this idea.
She sounds like the absolute crack. Yeah. She sounds like great fun. We must go into her story again some other time, perhaps, when we have some other week where there isn't a news hook to hand something on. You mentioned that it's your belief that Iona is what prompted the state into action, and then sure enough, eventually, Lammas did that.
Yeah, and so much of the economic story of Ireland in that decade and subsequent decades, you know, Sean Lammas is to the fore. And Lammas is an odd thing because he's a veteran of the Irish Revolution. He'd been in the Rising. He's an old school Irish nationalist on one level, but he also believes in the global capitalist model and that Ireland can be at the heart of that. And he's really pushing for an Irish national airline. He'd been obsessed with this idea. I think he felt it would open Ireland up to the world economically. Of course, Lammas ended up on the front of Time magazine. Like he was the great economic success story of Ireland. But there were one or two voices of opposition, actually, even in Fianna Fáil, who wondered that if it would lead to increased emigration, which is interesting because, we always say, even today, if someone emigrates to Britain, he got the boat or he's got the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
That's still said. But the first Aer Lingus pilot, Oliver Armstrong, was actually a graduate of Iona National Airways. So in many ways, this kind of the UCAHL idea had laid the foundation blocks, you might say, for Aer Lingus, which came later.
Yeah, it's a curiously defeatist attitude to take, isn't it? The idea that if you make it easier for people to get off the island, that they just will and they'll never come back. But I suppose it's the psyche of the early 20th century when you've come through everything in the decades previous. Aer Lingus, very briefly, just to finish up, the image of itself that it created, perhaps maybe as a counterpoint to Iona, it was always trying to present itself as a very classy affair.
Absolutely. Gone was the daredevil kind of image of Iona. And the historian Mike Cronin, I think he's nailed it about Aer Lingus. He says everything about Aer Lingus spoke of home, a real one if you were Irish, or an imagined one if you were Irish American. The image that they sold. And when you read even the advertisements for air stewardesses in the 40s, applicants must be between the ages of 21 and 26. They must be between 5'2" and 5'6" in height. Their weight must be from 7.5 to 9 stone. They must also be beautiful, intelligent, and well educated, have a good knowledge of Irish and French, and if possible, an extra language, a language such as Spanish or German. I mean, it was a real high class thing, Aer Lingus.
That's an actual ad.
That's an ad for. And that was a very prestigious job.
Yeah.
And, it was all far removed from, from UCAHL's Field of Dreams and in Finglas. But I think UCAHL's vision, a bit like James Joyce in the cinema that flopped, the vision inspired everything that came later.
Well, it's definitely really striking that if Aer Lingus always marketed itself, and even that idea of, the classy calling of home, it's all the Gabriel's Oboe stuff in the 1980s, that it's always been like that. And maybe Ryanair then is in that Iona model where it sort of has to be that bit more maverick, that little bit more razzmatazz to try and punch its way through all the fog. Fascinating stuff as ever, Donald. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on that. Field of Dreams in Finglas. That's definitely going to be the podcast title when we put this up. All of Donald's hidden history slots, of course, are always available to listen back to in the Newstalk app or newstalk.com. Donald Fallon is a historian. He is the author of the Come Here to Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast online.